after the Simply His Coffee Shop, everyone. Today, we are starting a six-part series on the Ten Commandments. We thought it'd be a great idea to break them down and talk about what they really mean and why they are still so very important for today. On today's show, we will be focusing on Commandments 1 and 2, which are no other gods before me and no graven images. Donna, get us started on why the Ten Commandments are so important even in our lives today.
Yeah. Starting off with kind of how our culture approaches it, a lot of Christians do immediately look at that and go, if the Ten Commandments are in the Old Testament and Jesus came, why are we really focusing on that anymore? The rest of the Mosaic Law is not anything that we, you know, really, really stick to. I mean, we eat shrimp or we have blended clothing.
And eat bacon.
Like, yeah, right. So why are the Ten Commandments a part of that? Okay, here's the reason. Nine of those commandments were repeated in the New Testament.
Okay.
So we are given those things to continue. Now, the one that wasn't was the fourth one, the Sabbath. However, I want to point this out. It's because the Sabbath had a different kind of deliverance. In Deuteronomy 5:15, the purpose of the Sabbath day and keeping it holy is specifically stated so that the Jews would remember that God delivered the Jews from Egypt through a mighty hand and by an outstretched arm. Okay, so it's the deliverance that is the purpose behind the Sabbath. Now, in the New Testament, we have a different deliverance through Jesus Christ. He says in Luke 22:19, do this in remembrance of me. So we are still told this deliverance, which is not Sabbath day remembering Egypt anymore. Okay. It's this new covenant. We are told that we are supposed to still do this in remembrance of him, right? And then Paul, over in 1 Corinthians 11, he explains to the church at Corinth how to do the remembrance, the communion, to do it worthily, i.e., how to keep it holy. So we're still told that the fourth commandment is relevant to today. But instead of it being a Sabbath day from, you know, this hour to this hour and the whole Jewish celebration and the way that that would work, we're given a new covenant kind of remembrance to keep it holy. So having explained that really briefly, all 10 of the commandments are still extremely relevant to today. Now, some of the people that are listening to me right now, they're like, she didn't talk about the fact that the Sabbath is supposed to be one day and not the other. Okay. When we get to the fourth commandment, we'll get there. But just to cap that off really quickly, in Matthew 22:35-40, Jesus is asked, which is the most important commandment, right? One of those many moments where there's a New Testament challenge and repose. What his response is, thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart and with all thy soul and with all thy mind. And the second is like unto it, thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. On these two commandments hang the law and the prophets, meaning on these two commandments that Jesus just said, is all the other 10. What a lot of people don't understand is that those first four commandments are about our relationship with God. Next 5-10 are about our relationship with other people. So Jesus, by saying love God, love neighbor, he literally took all 10 and went, whoosh, there you go. Repackaged, right?
Yes.
So that is why the Old Testament 10 commandments are still relevant to us today.
And if you're following what Jesus said, loving the Lord with all your heart and soul and mind and loving your neighbor as yourself, you're not going to break any of these other commandments.
That's
just
right.
Just naturally out of the flow of your lifestyle.
Right.
You're going to be following all of the commandments anyway. You mentioned some of the prohibitions that are in the Old Testament that are no longer necessarily being upheld today, the blended fabrics and the things like that. A lot of those that are listed in the Old Testament are also because of the fact that they were done in conjunction with idolatrous worship. So actually, I brought a couple examples. In Deuteronomy 22:11 tells us not to wear cloth woven of linen and wool. Exodus 23:19 tells us not to boil a kid animal in his mother's milk. These are things that it's not about the practice itself that's innately sinful. It's basically how it's in conjunction with idolatrous worship and with pagan religion. So God's saying not to do that. So a lot of these things that people get hung up on about the prohibitions in the Bible, it's actually what God's saying is, don't practice idolatrous worship.
Right. Everything you just said segues perfectly into what I feel is going to be the true meat behind both the first and second commandments. So the first commandment is thou shalt have no other gods before me, right? And the second commandment is thou shalt not make unto thee any graven image or likeness of anything that is in heaven above or that is in the earth beneath or that is in the water under the earth. Thou shalt not bow down thyself to them nor serve them. Right. Now, on the first one, if you just want to isolate the first one, having no other gods before me, when you look at what happened when Israel did have other gods before him, it led to the Babylonian and Assyrian exiles. Their people were destroyed. Right. The tribe of Benjamin was practically obliterated off the map. This is the kind of stuff that happened when they said, we understand the Mosaic law and we're going to pay lip service to God, but we're really, our hearts are after these Babylonian gods or Assyrian gods or whatever territory that they were tempted by. So the warning is there, even though it's not stated, thou shalt have no other gods before me, or, you know, Babylonian exile and this, that, and the other. It can be interpreted with an innate, intrinsically woven into it, warning, don't do that or this will happen. Mm-hmm. So because the first and the second commandment, they kind of go hand in hand.
Right.
Yeah. That's why we're dealing with them both together on this episode. I want to respectfully, right off the tail of what Allie just said, I want to be the odd man out in the Christian group today. In my childhood, from, I want to say, almost every single time I ever heard the Ten Commandments, that idolatry and that kind of thing could be anything you put before God. It could be the Xbox.
Yep.
It could be your career.
Right.
This is the very, very, very frequent teaching in the church. Now listen, the whole Bible makes the statement not to put other things more important than God, right?
Absolutely.
Okay, collectively, it's a no-no. I'm not saying the Bible doesn't say that, but specific to the commandments. We are thousands and thousands and thousands of years removed from what these prohibitions were, and from what the original Hebrew words said.
Good.
So you got to take the very, very, very beginning. I want to say this respectfully. The Hebrew does not even imply that an idol or a god before Yahweh, Jehovah, or Jesus Christ can be an Xbox or a career or things like that.
And a lot of people don't know that.
Well, no, that's not what you're taught in church.
Let me, again, very respectfully explain why that is really, really very bad theology. When you teach an entire congregation of people that if they play too many hours of the Xbox, that's an idol. And when they just keep on working too hard for their career, for their family, that's an idol. Everything is an idol.
Yeah.
You cannot get away from idolatry.
Yeah.
What it does is it overtly, over a gradual period of time, in a psyche of a Christian, it gradually makes the statement in the back of our psychology that God cannot be pleased.
Every time
we make a mistake, it's idolatry.
Wow. Oh,
that donut this morning was idolatry. My Xbox is idolatry. Everything in the world is idolatry.
You're defeated.
If you're a parent, you can understand what I'm saying.
Yeah.
If you teach your child that cookie is wrong, you just took a toy from that other child, that was wrong. And the Lord, if you get too preachy with the child, they're going to grow up feeling like this is the unpleasable God.
Mm. Yeah.
Wow.
And every time I was taught anything can be an idol, which is not what the Hebrew says, I grew up with that evangelistic preach tone in the back of my mind. Everything.
Yeah.
Every other day, I was guilty of idolatry. I was worshiping other gods. Historically, the Jews were literally worshiping other idols.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Idols made out of wood, stone, covered in gold and silver. They were literally worshiping other idols. That is what's being addressed here.
Right.
So when we want to try to, you know, make the word relevant to today, sometimes people with the greatest of intentions will see that and pull out of it a meaning and make a great sermon out of it, but it's simply not what the Bible says. Mm-hmm. The Hebrew word for idol in that very prohibition straight out of Exodus 24 and 5 is pesel, okay? Now, that word means carved wood or carved stone. That is literally what that word means. And the root word behind that is pasal, and it is the verb in Hebrew that means to carve.
Okay.
So when you take the carved idol, literally what it's referring to in Hebrew, and you turn it into other Xboxes and things, what happens is a gradual diluted attitude, approach to the idol. If everything's an idol, then eventually people are like, well, you know, yeah, you say that I can't worship this golden calf, but yesterday you called my Xbox a golden calf. So eventually the entire prohibition falls under a gradual cultural dilution. We need to allow the verse to mean what it originally meant. Mm.
I find it funny that you keep referring to it as an Xbox, because I've heard it taught, you know, anything can be an idol. It can be this or this. But I remember specifically this being really a main thread when we were in youth group. And those were our teen years when the big temptation for teenagers was to play too many video games. And so you keep saying Xbox because that's the one that was really hounded at the years that you were hearing this a lot. When you take the first two commandments, basically it's God establishing who we worship, which
is
only him.
That's right.
And then how we worship him.
Yeah.
So this idea that we're not supposed to prioritize anything above God, that is biblical. And that concept is theologically sound. But the idea that in this commandment that he's generalized it down to that level, that's not true. That's theologically what he's addressed is specifically the building of hand-carved idols that you worship as though they're a deity. And it's kind of funny because it reminds me of when Abraham went up onto the mountain, you know, and he had Isaac there and he was going to sacrifice Isaac. And this God lets this whole thing play out knowing that he's going to send an animal to be the sacrifice. Right. But it's basically God's way of saying, I don't want to be worshipped like your false pagan gods.
Right.
I won't accept that kind of worship. I want to be worshipped on my terms, the way I expect to be worshipped. And him making that statement and making it very clear.
One, he was breaking the mold.
Mm-hmm.
He was changing the mold. He was saying, this is not how we do it anymore.
Yes.
This is your old life. It's the whole new creation.
Right.
But once you let all the old go,
right,
then you become the new.
Yeah.
And I think that's what he was doing in that moment, was he was saying, Abraham, this is what you used to do.
Right.
Now, this is the way that I expect to be worshipped, because Abraham grew up, you know,
in Ur.
Exactly. So it was a very paganistic culture that they would sacrifice their children. So God used it as a segue. Say, no, we don't do this. This is not worshipful for me.
The lamb.
Right.
Yeah.
This
right.
is the lamb that you have to use in place. I think that's interesting.
One of the things that that comes to my mind, because when you look at these little carving, little images, they are stone. There's nothing in them.
Yes. Yeah. There's no life.
No life. It's just, and what you do for that is a ritual. It's whatever the ritual things that they do for this little thing.
Mm-hmm.
But God is not that. He is alive.
Mm-hmm.
And so he wants us to communicate and to have a living relationship with him. Something that is two-way, not just a one-way. And I think that as far as God, he really wants us to do that. He wants to have that
personal,
precious personal relationship mm-hmm. with him. And I think he's jealous of that if you give that to some
nothing,
stone.
Some nothing idol.
I mean, the stone don't deserve it.
Yeah.
He does.
He created the stone.
Exactly. Exactly right.
Well, it's true that, you know, in both testaments, we understand that an idol made out of wood and gold and silver and so on is not a literal god. It's mm-hmm. not going to bless you in any kind of literal way or protect you in any kind of literal way. But as a warning, Paul did come in there and say, you know, the surface of these things are crawling with demons. So it's not entirely just this innocent right. little thing. If you have this and you worship it, you are inviting things into your life. And this actually brings up another question that is so, so, so relevant right now. What is the difference between religious artwork and an idol?
Mm.
Because I've seen that terribly abused. When I had my miscarriage and we lost Charlie, my mom, Nita, she bought me a beautiful little tiny statuette of a little redheaded girl. Mm. Charlie, it was a tomboy name, but Charlie was actually a girl.
I have a niece named Charlie, so
yeah.
I get it.
Yeah. And there was no God in this thing.
Right.
This was not, it had nothing to do with anything religious, but I did have a friend, and very respectfully so, a friend that came and visited me said, okay, so if we're not allowed to have any idols, then what is that? I'm like, okay, this needs to be
it's a tchotchke.
That is a reminder of the baby that we lost.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
That was a soul that is now, I can't wait to meet her. I already know she looks like Merida on Brave. I know it. I've dreamed of her.
We do have to take a really quick break, but this is such a great conversation, and we will pick it right back up. We'll be right back.
The winter season is finally upon us, and we have the perfect package to keep you warm and cozy on those cold, snowy nights. Still wishing it was a holiday season with all those pretty lights and presents under the tree? Well, why don't you try our Spicy Earl Grey Tea? It's one of our host's favorites. With its classic taste, beautifully combining a sophisticated black tea with hints of spice to make it the ideal Christmas in a cup. Up early digging out the car, face the cold with a rejuvenating cup of our dark blend, fairly traded, all-organic Tornado Watch coffee. Its strong body with dark chocolate, fruit, and nut flavors will give you the boost you need to get your day started off right, or give you that mid-afternoon jump to finish off your day strong. Our Tornado Watch coffee is the cup of joy you need to warm yourself from head to toe during this winter season. This package also includes our charming blue Simply His ceramic mug. And finally, to help inspire you this new year and your future spring cleaning dreams, we've included the book Live Happy by beloved couple from HGTV, Dave and Courtney Wilson. Live Happy is full of beautiful, inspiring pictures and fun, easy-to-digest snippets, making it a helpful, unintimidating way to learn new tips, tools, and tricks for your home and family. You may also find it helpful as you prepare for some new DIYs to try out this spring. Read Live Happy for practical ways to take the house and make it your home. To find out more about the Simply His Winter Package and to place your order today for only $25 plus shipping and handling, shop Simply His online at skywatchtvstore.com or call 844-750-4985.
To the Simply His Coffee Shop. We were having a very exciting conversation right before we had to break, though. We were talking about religious figurines and artwork. Donna, take us away with that one.
Yeah. So there's this period in history called the Byzantine Iconoclasm. Now, if we go into that at length, I'll be talking about Joan of Arc until Thursday. The point is, to collapse it down, there was this moment in history where the well-meaning folks up in very high in the religious hierarchy were saying, these people are venerating this image. They've got a, you know, a picture, a statue of Jesus or more Mary or whatever, and this is idolatry. So we've got to crush that down, right?
And this is based on the idea that they were breaking the second commandment by creating graven images or art. So it became illegal, basically, within religious circles.
Well, and the second commandment does say, graven image or likeness of anything that is in heaven or in heaven above or on the earth beneath or the water below. It specifically includes God in that. So if you have a statue of Jesus and you're worshiping that statue, it's still idolatry. How do you make the connection here? Now listen, churches everywhere, people's personal property all over the place. Aunt Margaret painted a painting of Mary in respect. Everybody was getting arrested. Their houses were set on fire.
Wow.
Iconography, beautiful statues and images that we can never recreate that were, you know, as brilliant as something Michelangelo would have created, was destroyed in this moment because the hierarchy of the church decided to see that all religious artwork, period, was idolatry. So eventually that got reversed. And I'll tell you, with keeping it short, the testimonies that occurred in court, one testimony after another, a person saying, look, I was not worshiping the image or the painting or the statue. When I walk by that, I want to fall on my knees before God because I am reminded of the majesty of him. It's it's not a likeness of him that I worship in my heart.
No.
Right. It is simply something that is
a visual reminder.
A visual reminder. And that is what eventually reversed the iconoclasm and gave us back the religious right to own art. Now, listen, people do at some point say, well, would God ever approve of religious art at all? I mean, is it in the Bible? Yes, it is. As a matter of fact, we have religious artwork occurring in Exodus, just after the commandments, by the way, just after the commandments in Exodus 25, God personally instructs Moses to form the likeness of a cherubim, which is often heard in English as cherubim, that occur on the top of the Ark of the Covenant. Later on in Numbers 28:8-9, God instructs Moses to build the bronze serpent. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And by the way, later on, that bronze serpent was worshipped, and King Hezekiah in 2 Kings 18:4 tore it down for that very reason. So we have a precedent that religious artwork that represents something, you know, is allowed if we take it to the extreme and say absolutely no likeness of God, absolutely never. Your cross necklaces and earrings have to go. I mean, you see what I'm saying?
Absolutely. Yeah, right.
You see how absolutely out of
That's dangerous too, because following the Byzantine iconoclasm, after all the religious artwork had been destroyed, then they decided, okay, now we're allowed to have religious artwork again. And we misunderstand this in America because we have freedom of speech and freedom of religion.
Right.
Yeah, we forget that these people got real serious about this stuff. Yeah. You could get executed, like she mentioned, your house being burned. But then when they decided, okay, we're allowed to have religious artwork again, then what they did was they had no previous reference of some of this artwork that had been done respectfully with scripture in mind. So now all of a sudden our angels look like Nike or Mercury. These are ancient Greco-Roman deities. And so what ended up happening is when they went to re-depict in art form, what does a holy angel look like? What does a spiritual being look like? Now they're all starting to look like Greco-Roman deities, which is why if you go into a modern church today and you look at the wall and you actually know what you're looking at, half the time you're looking at a painting of a Greco-Roman deity.
Right.
I mean, we've got the characters of the pantheon all over our churches because at some point in time,
we lost the reference.
Exactly. So that's what happens with fear and legalism.
Mm-hmm.
When we go through and completely wipe everything out and diminish all of it and say absolutely none of this. And then all of a sudden, when people go, hold on, there might be some balance.
You get a
false depiction. From point A, no idea what it even is.
Ugh, that's so sad. Can you imagine walking into a museum today if we actually had the benefit of, you know, the artwork that was destroyed?
Yeah.
That would be fantastic.
Well, our angels would certainly look quite a bit differently.
Wow. They really would.
I mean, good grief. The Nike and Mercury thing that you mentioned. Okay, so nowhere in the Bible does an angel have wings. Okay, and so there's going to be some people that are listening to me like, no, in the throne room. No, those are seraphim. Those are a completely different character in the Bible. Those are throne room guardians, and they have more than the two wings. It's a totally different thing. But angels don't have wings anywhere in the Bible. And the earliest frescoes, the earliest paintings and carvings, angels looked like regular men. And think about it. Every time they appear in scripture, people think they're men. But they're so fearsome that one of the first things they always say is fear not.
Yeah.
So
yes.
Why do we have this concept about angels that they're these big flowery things? And why are they always women? You know what I'm saying?
Well, that we got that from the Greco-Roman pantheon.
We got that from the Greco-Roman pantheon.
Yeah,
that's
feminine.
Right.
Yeah.
Huh.
Yeah. I saw the Rembrandts. They were put on tour because the museum where they're normally hosted was under renovation. And so they took them around. And I was in Portland, Oregon at the art museum there. And a bunch of those paintings came through. And I can't explain to you what it's like to stand in front of something painted hundreds of years before you were born.
Mm-hmm.
You're not allowed to touch it. And they have all this caution tape, man. The security there is crazy. Mm-hmm. But you can get close enough to see the cracks in the paint and the brush strokes and things like that. It would be amazing to see that artwork. It's just a neat experience.
Yeah.
You feel so small.
Well, big time.
The scope of everything.
Not too far from where we live. You know, Crystal Bridges is just down in Arkansas. And we've been down there a couple of times. And you stand reverently almost.
Mm-hmm.
And some of those, you know, depictions are like, wow. And it makes you think of then and what they've been through and like the little, you know, if they're using, you know, different types of mediums, you know, the lifting and the thickness of the paint and all that. I can't imagine not having the benefit of that. That's so sad.
And so the same way you're talking about standing in front of a painting and seeing it only as a painting created by human hands, it's not a deity, but it causes a stir of reverence in you that makes you realize you're a small piece of a much bigger picture.
For sure.
I mean, I think part of the reason that so many people right now are struggling with things like anxiety and depression is because they don't feel connected to a bigger story, bigger creator who has a plan. Yeah. And to be able to stand back and see anything that reminds you that life is so much bigger than this moment in time, this weird little struggle you're going through today. There's a whole overarching storyline here that's been masterfully created by somebody who's in charge of all of it. Yeah. Capital S on it's, somebody. It's, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The idea that a painting or a statue would stir that kind of reverence, that's when it could be a permissible thing.
Right.
But then if you walk up to it and you bow down and you start worshiping a saint or you know, a sainted person or whatever, and now you're worshiping that, okay, now you've got a problem because we're not supposed to be worshiping anything made by human hands.
One of the ministries that we work very closely with, they have erected a giant Jesus when you enter their main headquarters. And I remember that this was years and years ago when I first went there, and some of the teaching of the church about how even a Jesus statue is an idol was kind of swirling in my head, and I didn't know how to feel about it.
Right.
I hadn't worked it out yet. And I walked in and I saw this, and part of me was like, what do I do about that? And the other part of me, I was looking at this head to toe, and this Jesus statue is big. Yeah. It's enormous. It's like 15 feet tall.
Yeah.
And I remember looking up and seeing what was the human created Jesus. And I did the up down and I got to the bottom and I'm just like, oh my gosh. And I remember out loud what came out of my mouth. One of those times when I was talking out loud and not even thinking about it.
Yeah.
I said, Lord, if I'm this impressed with man's handiwork, in an act of worship to you by creating this, how much more?
Oh,
I can't even say this.
Yeah.
How much more am I going to spend the first million years in eternity on my face in front of you?
Yeah.
That is the power of what God has given man, the equipment to create that beauty.
Yes.
Okay? Mm-hmm. Not all religious artwork is wrong. It is the worship of religious artwork that is
absolutely
wrong.
That's it.
If I was that moved and that floored emotionally just by seeing what I knew to be only a work of man, and not even a reflection of what Jesus really looks like. It's just somebody's best guess. I know that.
Yeah.
Right.
But I thought, if I'm this floored by that, oh dear God, I can't even imagine how I'm going to feel when I see the true Christ.
Yeah, that's good. That's good.
That's not idolatry, right?
No, not at all.
It is not idolatry.
No. Well, we are all out of time again. Man. So sad every week when this time comes. But please don't miss next week. We will be talking about the third commandment, which is taking the Lord's name in vain. And it might not mean what you think it means. Join us next week in the Simply His Coffee Shop.